This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Hello, my name is Benny Tran. I am Executive Vice President of the Los Angeles Football Club, most recent and current MLS champions. I am originally from Atlanta, actually born in New Orleans, raised in Atlanta, Georgia, so Southern. And had a wonderful journey in my life and my career where it took me to all around the world, including the Middle East, East Africa, and spending a lot of my time in Vietnam, studying in Vietnam, and now here I am in Los Angeles working in sports.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world. Thank you for coming on, Benny. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays, man?
It's a very interesting question. I hear an answer on your podcast every single time. Obviously, this is the intro. It is an evolving thing for me. It is one thing and it is everything at the same time to be Vietnamese. It is who I am by blood. It is who I am culturally because of my parents. I am Vietnamese-American for a lot of purposes, but also am not Vietnamese for other purposes, for example, when I'm in Vietnam. But I've been very fortunate to experience, I would never trade anything for being Vietnamese, but all my experiences in my life, whether it was good or bad. And I think it's unique in a sense that in today's world of identity politics and culture, but also at the same time, being able to live in Vietnam for almost 10 years, experience living in Vietnam and understanding the country of Vietnam, the culture of Vietnam, and the people of Vietnam, which, you know, I don't necessarily share extreme commonality with, right? But I think that's what it is. It's a lens of which I see things through. It is how I am identified by people and people around me, good and bad. And I can't leave the food out. I love Vietnamese food, and you know this. And I am extreme with my Vietnamese food, and that's mostly what I cook. And I love Vietnamese food more than anything in the world. So, except for chicken wings, perhaps.
You are one of the few guys. There's a few guys in my circle that I aspire, and I don't say this lightly, but I aspire to be the kind of Vietnamese that you are. You know, somebody who is extremely confident with their roots, but also recognize, like what you just said about when you're in Vietnam, you're not really Vietnamese or doesn't feel Vietnamese. And that's like a big admission. But right, the kind of the acute awareness of not really being of Vietnam when you're in Vietnam is also a beautiful thing to kind of understand.
I appreciate that. I consider myself lucky for having that experience because not many people do so. I think a part of that also is kind of my journeys around the world. You know, I funny enough, I was convinced to study Arabic in high school because my brother said, you need to do this to separate you from apart from everyone else in college applications. It was evidence in high school in our programs where we had Chinese and Arabic, where, you know, students were going and being successful in getting into college. And then I was, you know, had a tough time growing up in the middle of non-Asian Atlanta. And in a really poor neighborhood to find identity in, I guess, in the midst of a lot of, you know, racism or judgment, stereotyping. And I didn't want to be Vietnamese or Asian. So I chose Arabic. And through that journey, it was kind of my first time abroad, experiencing a new culture. I absolutely fell in love with it. But what was interesting, I remember the first time I flew to Vietnam on a plane to do my Fulbright there in 2002. I was on that plane and I was landing. I was like, oh my God, I'm here in my home country. It's going to feel like my mother country. Then I get off the plane, the morass of people outside waiting and see my name, my cousins. And they're like, hi. And I was just opened my mouth and said hello and said something in Vietnamese, like, oh, you are not Vietnamese. And that hit me right in the face, right? And that kind of informed me, of that was really first impression of what I was to them. And then it was a journey. And then studying abroad in other countries and seeing how people treated me as a foreigner. And then in Vietnam, you realize that the shared experience of you as a Vietnamese is not the same as theirs, and you got to be
Yeah.
cognizant of that. And like it's an, and we've had many discussions about Vietnam, Vietnamese American, the politics and the context. But the reality of, we may have we're lucky enough to grow up in America. Well, there are a lot of people who struggled and grew up during the 70s, 80s, 90s, or even now who are enjoying the economic growth of Vietnam and the young people of Vietnam that are having a great life living in that current economy and society at the moment.
You and I have spent quite a bit of time together, and I've looked forward to this interview for a very long time. And thank God we waited. Thank God. I don't know if you planned that or you calculated that, but geez, thank God we waited because, first of all, congratulations on the LAFC team's championship win in the MLS. It's like I just cannot believe the serendipity of us waiting for to do this interview, because we could have done it a long time ago just based on how long we've known each other and how much time we spent. Did you plan to, I mean, why did you wait so long? I mean, it's so wise that we did wait for this.
No, I look. Things happen for a reason, I think. There was no purpose and reason other than the fact that I want to keep pushing. I was busy or not busy, but didn't commit to this interview, to be honest, at some time. And things recently got very busy. And landing on a spot of becoming MLS champions, it has been a good piece of work in my career for a good almost 8 years to today. It was a the idea was born out of Henry Nguyen, founding owner, and he brought me into the project. And we had an I we didn't have an idea, but we had an idea of how we wanted to build a team in Los Angeles where there were other 11 other professional sports teams, competitive market, and how do we grow this amazing team, amazing people in the organization from the business side to the performance side. Amazing owners, and the performance side obviously is the top layer here as players and who won us the championship as well, but also on the other side of the organization in terms of brand building the community here in Los Angeles. I think it all came together. We were so close before COVID hit, and here we are as MLS champions. It was a very emotional day when we all won. A lot of people were crying afterwards, fans, employees, owners, together. And I think it was a moment of joy and an emotional moment of joy, and really a capstone to the hard work that everyone put in, including, people who are the supporter section, and the passion, the love. The game was so tight. And I'd love to quote my partner in crime and colleague and buddy, Richard Ross, who was our head of branding. He said, when we're tied, when we're losing 3-2, down near when the game was almost ending, he said, there's too much love in the stadium for us to lose. And lo and behold, he tied it and won the penalty kicks.
You know, I have always worn an LA Dodgers hat, the baseball hat, and it because I love the logo. But Jesus, the logo that I wear now for the LAFC hat, I wear it everywhere. I wear it to New York. I'm so proud of it. And the thing about it is this: it's like I'm not a really big sports person, and we'll get into that. And the fact that I'm not a bandwagon guy. Because of you, I'm not a bandwagon guy. I feel like I was there from not day one, but early enough, and kind of like, oh no, I was wearing, the gear and being part of this experience because of, really through you, because I don't really, I'm not a really big sports guy. So it has added another dimension to my life to wear this gear, and it's such a privilege and an honor to be part of that sort of story of my home city. But how did it really come about? Because you're not from here, Henry's not from here. Did the original idea come from Henry? Like he just thought, like, I'm gonna do this, or like, where did this germ of an idea for a soccer team in LA? We already have the Galaxy here, right? What, where did it come from, and what's the origin story?
Oh, so it actually came from the fact that the league did buy back a second team in Los Angeles back. It was
Which
pre
team?
it's called Chivas LA or LA Chivas. I don't know the formal name. So in fact it was technical, right? And then that was taken back to the league and they were actually posted it for sale and as a bid. So Henry was one of the bid groups that submitted and won. And then when he won the franchise, he invited me to explore and possibly work and really work with the team and building out the franchise. So that's really where it came from. And then also before that, I worked with Henry to build the Saigon Heat basketball team, and he has done wonders in terms of building sport. He's built the basketball league and also basically the NCAA of sports. In Vietnam, which is very interesting and something needed, I think, in terms of when it comes to identity of college. And we talk about identity, and I think this is something that's really interesting. Is really sports is represent is one avenue of representing as a person, a city, a region, a country. And this is all timely too, because I'm leaving for Qatar tomorrow, going to the World Cup, and that's the ultimate world competition between countries, and behind it is country pride and sport. And so that's how it came to being. I mean, and once you receive the franchise, you got to figure out how to build out the club. And there were many people involved in that, including people from Los Angeles, that was part of building out the team. Sports, people from non-sports, it was a diversity of thought, I think, that existed that really propelled what we were thinking about doing, how we did it, planned it, and executed it. But there were fundamental elements, right? We were here in a competitive market. LA, Los Angeles is a very complex place. I've never been here before, even stepped foot into Southern California before I even came here for an interview and took the job.
Wow.
And in terms of me, look, I love understanding, different countries, different cities. And this is one of the cities I never knew and understood and actually had to explore and understand, much like I did in Cairo when I arrived, much like, Dar es Salaam or, Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, because LA is wide. I thought Santa Monica and Hollywood were downtown. That was literally what I thought when I landed. And it's a very complex place.
And the irony is, some guy who thought Hollywood and Santa Monica was downtown is the guy that takes me to new restaurants in my own city now. It's crazy. You take me to at least a good three or four new places, and I know that that's just like scratching the surface for you. You know all the good restaurants, hole in the walls, and the big restaurants. You know all of them here, and yeah. But I mean, I think that's the beauty of somebody who doesn't live here is the exploration of a city like LA. It's very complex. I've long
Very,
given up on trying to keep track of everything.
yeah, I mean, complex and a sense of discovery, right? And there's a lot of intentionality in what you do on a daily basis in LA, given the geographic nature of it and also the cultural nature of
Yeah.
it. But if you're intentional about exploration, that's also very different. But it's a wonderful city, and we've had the goal of bringing a championship here, but also building a brand, building something that people can believe in. And people, something that can represent people, and I think that we've done a decent job at it. A pretty not a bad job at it, and there's more work to be done. Raising kind of the awareness of the sport and as a team, we had a competitor down the street for a long time who'd been in the market for a while, but we saw the opportunity and we saw what we can do, we could do. And there was a lot that we got wrong along the way, and there's a lot that we learned. And I think that's really what was the most important, was we learned and we really put all that forward. And that, you experience not just the brand and the team, but also the stadium experience and kind of how we interact with the city in a sense and through, our channels of social media and whatnot.
You know, when you walk through the stadium and you're walking around looking for your seat or getting a beer, my experience is it goes back to Henry and you. I think about that. Like literally when I'm walking through the stadium with our friends, I'm like, how the fuck is this possible where these Vietnamese guys are the ones that drove this stadium into existence? And knowing sort of like now the championship, getting that championship and knowing that there's a Vietnamese man up at the highest level of this game, of this, this is a countrywide acknowledgement of excellence, and there's you and Henry behind it. It's such a point of pride because it's all Latino, it's all black, it's all white, it's all everything, and there's very few. There are Asian peoples in the stands, but you walk through and you're like, this is the mastermind of these Vietnamese guys. I'm so fucking proud of that when I walk through that stadium. And that's why I could wear the gear, the hat, and with so much pride, because I know, it's my city. And it's also these Vietnamese men that are behind the driving force of getting to this point.
I appreciate that. I'm glad we can represent. But honestly, that's not how the lens will we see it through. And then when somebody suggests that or says that, like, oh, that's actually in fact true. I mean, look, there's not a lot of Asians who are executives or owners within professional sports. But even how we built the city was based on the fact that it was a diverse city, and we want to embrace
Yeah.
the diverse city. There's things that we had goals for. We want to represent the crowd, to represent the city of LA. And if there's not enough Asians, that we're hoping to get more Asians here. Even at the time, we were actually trying to work these things out and build the thesis behind and how we would implement addressing the city. I thought, hey, let's market segment, let's do this, let's just send this message to the Vietnamese. And Rich was like, hey, be patient. We are just have principles of which we want to share with the city. We had principles such as be a force for good, bring joy, and really for everyone in the city, and see how they come. And as we build it, it doesn't happen overnight. And even we're still building now, but I think the fan base, I would if you ask our fans today at the city, why do you feel great by going to Banc, California? And look, we have all the technology stack, the fan stack, all these good things. But I think one of the things they'll say up front is we feel, well, everyone's welcome here. And I think that's something that we're proud of, and we're very happy about, and we continue to work on that.
And you can feel it. You can feel it. I have, as you know, El Salvadorian cousins, first cousins, that were fans before I even knew of LAFC. Before it was even on my radar, they were going to the games, in years past. And the outpouring of fandom from them and their, 30, 40 friends that I know, it's what you say. It's like it. I realize by design and the blueprint, obviously of knowing you now, there is a specific way, because when you go to Dodger Stadium, I've been to a Dodger game, and you don't feel that, because it's just sort of like it's bigger and it just has this sort of like it's more of an American, white American kind of pastime. But when you go to LAFC's game, you feel the inclusion. That's like the beauty of it. You feel welcomed, and even if you're a white person or somebody in the majority, you still feel like this is a place for you.
Yeah, and I have to give credit to the fans and the supporters and all the people in the stadium as well, including the people who are the part-time employees who are guest services and security. There's a sense of community that has been built. Like, for example, when you come to a game, we don't have tailgates in the parking lots. We do what we call a family picnic in the grassy area in front of the stadium. That's where the supporters set up before they come to the game, and sometimes 6 hours, 8 hours before, they bring their own brewed beer, cooked food. And they welcome everybody. If you walk up to one of these tents, hi, they're like, hey, would you like to some ceviche? I mean, you can see our security guards have become friends with them, and they share food and break bread together before they go and work into the game at there. And same thing also kind of, in the stadium as well, right? You say in the Figueroa Club, which is one of the spaces where I have tickets in, people celebrate birthdays together and know each other. And yes, we created an environment that we're hoping that would happen. But that's really among people. And the commonality is LAFC and the passion for not just the game of soccer and the players, but really for what it means to be there or be a part of LAFC and be, supporting the team.
And Latinos are a big family. They're just as much into family as Vietnamese people. I mean, it's a clear, you could feel it. There's families there, and when you go to that grassy area, you could just see how tight these that the community is. Do they have to get permits and do they have to get anything before they set up these canopies?
I'm pretty sure there's something set up, but that's a known thing that we have it set up for, have the opportunity for everyone to celebrate with each other.
Yeah. You were there from ground zero. I mean, literally before ground zero. Can you tell me about like a broad overview on the process of how the stadium and how the team was built?
In terms of just how we're looking at building it, we started early. So December 1st, it's October 30th is when the team was announced. I joined the team on December 1st. And when I landed, the first order of business was how do you figure out how to build a stadium? And then, we had to secure that, secure the land, find a piece of land to do that, secure the land, and then figure out how to build a stadium. And that was my first project that I
What
had
was
taken.
there before the stadium?
It was a sports arena, so that's where I believe the Kings played. I believe the Clippers played there. Maybe the Lakers played there for a little bit before they moved to the Forum. I may be wrong. That's also where Bruce Springsteen played every year. That was
At
his.
the arena. So this is on the site of the original LA Arena. This
This
is the
is the original.
Olympics was held there here too, right? Like there's parts of the Olympics that 1984.
I'm sure there was something. It was built in the early 60s, I
Yeah.
believe. So this is an old sports arena that was that little round thing. It was there. It was with a fence around it. Nothing was being built there. And that was where we wanted to be. Also in the heart of Los Angeles in Expo Park, right in downtown, essentially. And it's interesting, kind of with the economic growth of Los Angeles, recentering of Los Angeles and downtown. And geographically, you think about that, it's a very important place to be, except that, the growth of LA didn't go that way until the last decade and a half or so, where now crypto.com, but Staples Center was built. And that still is the prime example or the benchmark for redevelopment at some level next to sports arenas is Staples Center, how it was rebuilt and it reopened downtown. As you know, downtown was not a great place to be for a long time. And when Staples Center was built in 2002, I believe, they started changing things. And aside from COVID, downtown is really a new center with development, people living there. And this is interesting in the context of Los Angeles, right? People don't know, like I didn't know, but you've always got the West Side, people talk about the West Side and Santa Monica and the beaches, but more than half the population lives east or in south. It's just that it's not necessarily the highest economic, socioeconomic neighborhoods of the city, but they're very important parts of how the city operates and how people live. Including San Gabriel Valley, where a lot of Asians do live, East LA, where Latinos live, and it's obviously mixed in South LA. So we're right in the center of everything.
So once you guys figured that LA Arena was the site where you're going to build the stadium, how long does it take to build the stadium?
There were multiple things working in parallel because we had to move so quickly. And we had the goal of building this by 2018, opened about 2018. So when you walk it back from 2015, you've got roughly 3 years and some change to figure out how to design, to get the land, design it, go to entitlements, and then build the thing. So luckily, we were able to move quickly. We had to get the lease under USC because that was under their purview. We had to sign an agreement with the state because it was lived within Expo Park. It was governed by those rules. And then in parallel, we hired our architects, construction managers, construction company, start designing the thing, and then securing the land, securing entitlements, designing all at the same time. And we broke ground in 2000, July or August 2016. We demolished the building and built it in 18 months. And it opened in April of 2018.
It sounded like a smooth ride, was it?
It was a fast ride. It's never smooth. And there were a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of hard work, but we got there. And it was an incredible moment when we opened the stadium. It was one of those nights where, you had those moments, what do you call those moments? I guess existential moments. It's like when I traveled to the pyramids and I always wanted to be an archaeologist. And I looked at the pyramids like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm here. It was one of those moments
Wow.
that day when we opened the stadium. So incredible. Incredible, we got it open. The branding, we had 17,000 fans sign up before the coach was even hired. that's kind of like, you know, one of the some of the elements of how we approach the brand. And then we opened the building and we started playing in 2018 through 2019. We lost in the Western Conference Championships 2019, and then COVID hit, and now here we are today in our fifth season with the Cup.
Amazing story. Now, when you look back, this resume that you have is not, it's not planned. I'm pretty sure you didn't say to yourself, all right, I'm gonna study Arabic in college and I'm gonna get out and I'm gonna stack my CV by building the stadium and then managing this team. I mean, what did you think of your life going, leaving college that you were gonna be doing?
Yeah, that's. I'm very fortunate to have such an eclectic resume, as one would say. Look, I had base principles, right? We grew up poor, we didn't have much, and how do we make sure that we don't have to live the life that we did before, or how do we actually build a life for our children, for which we don't have the experience, right? And I think that's really the baseline. And I think all of us kids of immigrants have maybe a similar goal and objective as we pursue those who are at least ambitious, I think, to pursue, or at least in the baseline of making sure that we're successful in general. And we don't have to grow up at foods on food stamps and line up for government cheese, as Charles Barkley says on the NBA. I mean, that government cheese was a real thing, you know, and how do we achieve, how do we be successful? And that could vary in many different levels. And for me, it was interesting because studying Arabic, and even though we were poor, my first experience in Egypt was the unbelievable level of poverty that existed. And that kind of where it informed where I first wanted to pursue my career. It was like, you know, I want to be a part of the solution. It could have been a diplomat, but it shifted to doing international development work. And I lived in Egypt twice, and that's what inspired me to pursue that. And I did pursue that. So fortunately, I did a Fulbright in Vietnam after school, and it kind of gave me a different perspective, you know, from the Middle East. And then I pursued a graduate degree with, you know, working in a consulting firm in between international development, public policy. And that, you know, you kind of need that to really launch your career in that field. And then I was fortunately sent to Vietnam to open the Clinton Foundation office there and to do the good work that we did around the world, but it's particularly in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. So that was, you know, where I pursued what I pursued then. And then, you know, I decided that it was time to move on my career and kind of go back to the private sector. And I was a fortunate to find myself at the soccer team. I never thought I would ever work in sports, even though I was a soccer fan and a sports fanatic. But that's also the principles of, you know, business skills and life skills, professional skills, you know, but it's just kind of a different flavor of it, right? And you know, it's interesting when you're building a club like this, it's all about social science and social behavior. So I was able to apply some of my learnings in my previous life to what is here. So I think being a non-Angeleno also helped me in terms of how I approach the work.
You went to Princeton, right?
For graduate school, yes.
For graduate school. And you know, we talk about this all the time, East Coast, West Coast. The experience of going to a school like Princeton to study what you studied, can you tell me a little bit about that and how it sort of informs your worldview?
In what sense? I guess
Yeah, I
academically,
think it
mentally.
the yeah, I think it's more like the question is, where do you kind of place the emphasis on education if you went to school on the West Coast versus on the East Coast? And how does it really kind of like inform the way you look at the world? Because it does. I've you know, I talk about this quite a bit on the podcast. Vietnamese East Coast look at the world a little differently than the Vietnamese on the West Coast.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the particular answer to the question as it relates to the West Coast in pursuit of something like this, right? So I'll just lay the groundwork of this. When you're in the field of international development, international relations, there's a pathway. And so when you study Arabic and you study a foreign language, you quickly realize if you do want to do that. Now, if you wanted to join the diplomatic corps, there's a pathway. You apply for the test, you go, or if you go to grad school, then you go. There's certain levels that you enter in. If you wanted to work in international development, you have to pursue. It's a really, really weird sector where if you don't have experience, you won't get hired. But if you don't get experience, you don't get paid to do that, get that experience. And then you have to go to grad school, right? So if you come from a lower socioeconomic status, you know, it is difficult. It's like limited jobs where someone's able to pay for SATs or get someone be sent to Africa to work, and then you get to go to work at the United Nations, something like that. So there's a specific pathway to get there, and you can make decisions on what the best schools are. At some level, you have to do a calculus of what the value is, right? Is it worth going to grad school for this or not? And if you do go for grad school, in my opinion, you have to go to the top five schools. If you don't, it doesn't necessarily mean that you won't be successful. I think the chances of her being successful, that's how the system works, is you go to the top five schools. So my goal was to focus on that, get there, and get to grad school, because I knew that was the next step to get at into these institutions. Things have changed where people do cross from business and MBA and whatnot. But that's really the pathway. Now, you have to be open to that. You have to know where the schools are. They're all on the East Coast, right? There are great public policy schools here on the West Coast, but they're primarily domestic, and there's like Berkeley, Gould, or top, top, top. But yeah, that's kind of how the pathway was and the pursuit of it. And you got to grind to get there. And you got to be open to it, and you got to know what you're focused on, and that's what you got to achieve. So I don't know if sure that answers your question, West Coast, East Coast, but
It does. And the reason I ask this is because there's a lot of kids that are Vietnamese American growing up in Southern California that are living in a bubble. And I know this now because I've now have given been invited to some of the high schools in Orange County and predominantly Vietnamese, 75% Vietnamese. Shout out to La Quinta High, Chris and Kimo over there. And I got this experience to listen to the teachers and the students. They don't sort of understand that there is more opportunity in the world to pursue other paths. And I think Kimo and Chris, the teachers, really push for that sort of like to inspire the children that there are these people like Benny Tran out there that are doing things that are I can't even fathom. Before I met you, I couldn't fathom that there were these positions in the world that's open to us. It's just simply because we're not exposed to it. That's it. And now that we get to see somebody like a Benny Tran on a podcast and listen to the sort of like the it's like an incongruent pathway that you have to kind of be open to allowing serendipity to take place, but also knowing that there's a grind to the process that you have to really be focused at achieving one thing at a time, and eventually it'll open up. And so that's why I'm very curious about that path that somebody like you would take.
that's interesting. I mean, I you, and look, I and what are the unique West Coast and East Coast and otherwise, and we can talk about how it's uniquely West Coast as well. I think it cuts the same way for neighborhoods that are poor. If you have a bad counselor, if you don't have a high level of graduation and sending kids to top schools, you don't really get educated or exposed to that kind of information. Same thing with parents of those students or where you live. Now, I think the proximity is one thing where it's important, where you kind of see. And then also you see kids on the East Coast, like, hey, that's pursuit for, going for Ivy, top schools, or going to great state schools there. So that level of exposure, and willingness to go to that, right? I think that's the fluidity of what happens more on the East Coast. Like if I'm Atlanta, it's like, okay, I go to school in New York, I go to school in Florida. I think that's a major difference here, is that the weather's beautiful here. I have my family here. The big East Coast is the big unknown, whether it would be weather, culture, they're not nice people, whatever it may be, people tend to stay here. And I think it's really critical for young people to explore beyond where their home base is. And I think it's a high level of commitment on both the parents and also the students to the parents let them go. Talk to a lot of folks here. They're on, no, my children need to stay close. I want them around. That's not so different from the East Coast in a certain level, like Vietnamese families. But here it's, I think it's like really acute, right? Like, no, wait, no, East Coast can't keep an eye on them. I don't know what's gonna happen to them. It all comes from a place of love, but also I think a recognition of exposing them to new things, new young adults to new things is critically important. And look, for all those parents out there, they're gonna love you more when they come back from the East Coast. I think that's a common result of, and I think it's better for everyone. And so my life has been about being exposed to new environments and new cultures, and in forms of who I am, and it also helps me in terms of, how I approach my life. But I think it's a wonderful thing to do, whether it be in America or beyond.
Yeah, it really is. And your exposure to the Middle East, your exposure to so many years in Asia, and now on the West Coast, it gives, as a young person, in high school, I hope that this gives them this sort of, because now I know that there's a lot of high school kids that are listening or being assigned to listen to this podcast, and so they can kind of expand the reality of their future, and it just doesn't have to be some traditional route. And traditional routes are great. It creates the stability of the foundation of our financial sort of footing in the new country. But at the same time, this representation that you are doing is so vital to living. It really translates to living a better life for Vietnamese people in America. Bottom line, I'll make that argument till the day I die.
Sounds great to me, but that's great. And shout out to La Quinta High and everybody else who's listening. But no, I think that's what it is. Keep that open mind. We talk about opportunities. There's still structural challenges to it, but keep your mind focused. We are lucky enough to be in a place where we have optionality as such and learn about more cultures. You have a choice to study Spanish. You have a choice to study abroad. Some may have financial restrictions, but go find it. I mean, I was lucky enough to have scholarships throughout my life to allow me to do these things. It was unique for an Asian guy to speak Arabic and pursue that, but that's how I got there, and figuring out the right pieces to allow for that pathway of opportunity, and then just be ready to take that opportunity, down the line.
Yeah, I want to take this back to representation. 4% is the Asian sort of, I think 4 or 6% now. I think 6% is Asian, the amount of Asians in America. In that 6%, I don't know, maybe we are 20% of that 6%. I don't even know if we're 1% of the United States. But why is it so important? And obviously, I have my own answer to that, but I want to know, why is it so damn important for less than 1% of a country like the United States to have Vietnamese people be in the positions that you, why is it important for me to advocate for guys like us to kind of be represented when the ratio in the United States is so off, right? Why do we get to demand this? Why should we demand it?
It's interesting. That's an interesting question. We don't think we talked about it in this particular context. I don't see it with kind of in that framework, right? I think it's just, the credible work that you're doing that I've come to realize, right? My exposure to the Vietnamese community here was almost nothing. And it wasn't much before I practically met you. I knew it existed. I knew that different circles existed, even in academia. And I think it's, important to have any group to be represented. And I don't think it's a ratio thing. I think it's the voices of us being represented in general and bring it to light. Look, I don't even know 90% of the people you interviewed, and I can't believe that who they are and how they are and what they're doing. And there's like a long list of them to come, as we always debate and talked about. But it's incredible, right? People should recognize who we are as an American and being successful. As an Asian American being successful, and also being Vietnamese to be successful. And as you said, there is something very important in terms of having people successful to represent and for people to aspire to. And I think as you talk about high school kids, and whether it be also a non-Asian, non-Vietnamese kid who can look at someone who can, rise in sports or rise in media and so forth. But it goes back to that. It goes back to also, making sure that there's a presence, say, for example, Asian American in Hollywood, to be expressed a certain way. And I think generally that's how I see the world and approach, and why that is important and relevant, but not necessarily, I don't think the ratio has anything to do with it necessarily. And why does it have to justify what we should or should not be represented as a small percentage of America? I think there are just a lot of voices here that need to be represented. And we've been working through this as a country for many, many years, ups and downs, even recently, and we continue to do so.
That's a great answer. Could be because I have a very myopic view, and it's because of people like you that opens me up. because, you know, I think of it as a simple mathematical equation. You know, we're a tiny population, and but you're right. It doesn't need to be a mathematical or ratio, it's something as an identifier, as a number. It's just we have stories and we don't want to be depicted as anything less than what we really are.
Yeah, I think that's right, exactly right. And it's incredible that we have, what we have now, and people who are rising to become at the forefront of literature and academia and so forth, right? And it's going to be a long journey in the future. And there's other ethnic groups that have been underrepresented for a long time, more than we have, and have bigger numbers if you wanted to do calculus. But that's what is being worked through, and hopefully, at the end of the day, all of us will become the country that we will be, and the diversity of which we are. And
You
our
know,
Los Angeles represents that too, right? Because
yeah.
LA is different from the rest of the country. Growing up in the South is a very different experience than growing up in a very diverse LA.
You know, in the early days, just to not to call you out, but you did question me, and I don't think you're questioning me personally. You're questioning how many Vietnamese people could you actually have on the show? And I remember with confidence, I said there's an infinite amount. And now that I'm getting into it, I stand by that 100%. There's an infinite amount of Benny Trans, Lo Van Pham. He's like a ref for the NFL now. There's Lee Nguyen. There's Eugene Trinh. He's an astronaut, former astronaut for NASA. These are people I don't even have reach. I haven't even been able to reach out to. And there's just that's a sort of sports and being an astronaut. But there's so many other interesting fields that within the world, you know, not just the United States, but that Vietnamese people have gotten into, and they've blown that whole idea of ratio out of the water. There's like, no, in some countries like Germany, you know, that it's not even we're not even a blip on that country, but we are in high offices and we've accomplished a great deal of work in all of these cultures.
Yeah, it's incredible, and I was completely wrong. And I think it depends on how it's represented, right? When you hear about the first Indian, British to become prime minister, or there's other ethnicities or groups that are represented, and use a different megaphone to espouse that. I think that this is where the megaphone is for us today. And the complexity is on top of this is what's going on in Vietnam, There, it's a whole country. It is a sovereign country that has its own people, its own systems, and own to worlds that have the people who are, run the country, own, run companies there, and the successes that are coming out of that, and how it may impact the world separately as a country versus just Vietnamese Americans alone. And I think that's, the interaction of it obviously is layered in history and politics that don't necessarily need to be on the thing. But that exists, but there's that side of the world too, and it's a different world. And it's incredible. And then you talk about Australian Vietnamese and German Vietnamese and Swedish Vietnamese, and they're all around. And I think that is diaspora. And what does that mean? And I think other groups or ethnicities have the same thing. And I think Vietnamese is it's coming to fruition in terms of through the channel, different channels such as yours, to learn like there are other people that are awesome around here and around the world.
You know, when we first met, we spoke a lot about food and we spoke a lot about religion and politics and international relations. We've had many nights of those kind of discussions. But it wasn't until recently. So I always thought of you as a big cultural guy because of food, politics, religion. I always thought of you as this, you know, this fountain of knowledge of those fields. Not until recently, we sat down for dinner. I made an introduction for a good friend of mine with you. And I sat and I listened for 2 hours to hear you talk about business. I was fucking blown away. I was like, wait, how is this possible that there exists this sort of like this massive knowledge of like this cultural side, but you got into the specifics of how you would bring in this partnership. It's a noodle company into a Latino, heavy Latino based, and your ideas just to, you have to understand it's like, it's almost like listening to somebody with an MBA talk from a marketing perspective. How did you get that amount of knowledge in business?
It's through, I was fortunate to just learn it through experiences, and working in business and working in non-business. I think that and look, there's a lot that I don't know either, right? But it's an evolution. It's something you learn from experiences, and you learn from other people. You learn from you learn from idols and reading books and reading as much as you can. And that's where it comes from. I think I can't pinpoint anything specifically. Working in management consulting really established a baseline for understanding the complexity of analyzing a business. The whole marketing thing, I don't pretend or portend or express that I'm a marketing expert at all. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like what your observations are. And everything is contributive to everything that you're trying to solve, including business, right? I understand the Latino market is social science at some level, and demographics, and understanding, talking to Latinos, understanding how it works in LA, understanding the market and market here, market there. And that doesn't necessarily come from just straight business. It comes from, understanding a population. And it's just like when you, it's social science when the market, what marketing is, right? You're trying to essentially effectively try to convince somebody to buy something, but it's also changing social behavior, right? So that's what that particular is. And you can see marketing professionals in the books they write and the books they read. So for example, David Brooks's Social Animals, great book. It talks about the human condition and how people think and what it takes to succeed and what are the barriers to succeed. And it's, it bakes in a lot of the academic studies around social behavior, right? And so those are the things that I read and pay attention to. And in a business like soccer and sports, you are selling a product on the field and a product that's a media product and it's an emotional product. So I'm not trying to sell you widget X. The widget X is actually more it's something on the field and something different, and that's why you need to think about. And even you're selling noodles, right? I mean, it's not, and it's changing. Everything's changing now with the influence of social media, and George Clooney of Casamigos. People buy it because of celebrities. People do buy it, because it's special. But brand and design are, very important elements. Partnerships. So there's a lot of layers to this that are really kind of based on how it occurs to people and how people engage in something. And that's not different from buying noodles to convincing someone to take an HIV test, but they're afraid to take one because they might be exposed. Someone else might find out. And so if you think about the commonalities that exist across, there is some there. And that's kind of how I learned that. And look, again, I talk about business and talk about my thesis, but I always try to learn more and make sure that that thesis is firm. And it's something that evolves and not necessarily is, you have to be open to, testing a thesis and A/B testing and to get to a good conclusion. And even your answer might be right the first year, might be wrong the next year.
Your important your answer is so important because I can imagine as a young kid, a lot of young boys and girls want to grow up to become millionaires, right? It's just a general sort of fantasy that a lot of young people have. You want to become a fan, you want to become a big person in the world. You want to, lead a company, you want to be a president, you want to do all these things. And but you're just having these thoughts, and even as a Vietnamese person sort of growing up when I was a kid, I was like, oh my God, I want to be rich. I just want to have it all. And I just want to get to the place where I'm leading a big company. What it takes now, now I'm seeing it a lot of the way this is playing out. There's no road. There's no specific road to any of the success. But what there is, how I feel is there's this sort of like buildup of just random knowledge, but on a deep level. Understanding things on a deep level, like what you said, the HIV model, probably it's your Clinton work, the Clinton Foundation work that you did, informs other parts of this sports journey for you. The Arabic, the living in Egypt, all of it eventually rounds out and allows you to one day become a president of a big organization like LAFC or yada yada yada. These things are a gradual, glacial sort of happening. It's not like when you're a young kid, you're like, well, let me just work really hard, go to school, and just focus on my one field, because it requires much more than that to have this sort of perspective to run a company like LAFC in the future, or another, you can probably laterally move into another industry with the amount of just the caked on layers of knowledge in culture and emotional sort of social understanding and business and numbers. You know, it really, I say this because I really encourage the young people of our generation, as well as people who are mid-level, you know, middle-aged, you know, people in the Vietnamese community, to think that we can get to these places, but we have to take risks, like a Benny Tran, right? Like, you just really have to take the risk to do work that's wider, to gain more perspective in the lives that we want to live.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment because, you know, look, there's different pathways to success.
Yeah.
My pathway was to make sure that I was lucky enough to be exposed to the private sector before I did consulting just because I was getting paid and I needed money to live and get to grad school. I did not know it was going to inform me so much of the foundation of how to approach business and then learn more, right? Because look, again, at the same time, after my experience, after the Clinton Foundation, I was like, I need to go back to the private sector. I was considering going to business school and fulfilling the skill set I needed to go into business or have both later on. So my goal was, you know, become a generalist so that I can set up for success wherever I go. Other people, if they want to become a doctor, you know what exactly that path is. There's things like finance where you can go, you know, to a school, learn finance, get a job in a financial institution, and then pursue that path. Every single step of the way, though, you need to map out what that path of success is, right? For example, if you want to get to a good school, you can't just get straight A's nowadays. You have to be interesting. And that's a fact of what they see in an application. So look, there's a lot more smarter people than I am. And how did it make me look different? My brother was spot on early on. Studying Arabic, it looks different. And how do you express that? How do you do that? And everything else does have to be firing at the highest levels. And I could have ended up at any program, but I knew that I needed to go to one of the top five programs in graduate school for public policy to have a good chance at to work with one of the top institutions globally. And so those are the things that you have to set path and people talk to people, learn more, read, so you know what that pathway is and then pursue it. It's probably the most important thing. And then you say, okay, what is my set of skills and background so that I can apply for it or set me up for success in the future? Look, trying to protect my downsides, the risk of any downside, right, in my pursuit of my career is the other bottom side of it, right? So that's how to think about it and pursue it. And that's kind of how I approached it. And hopefully I still go. I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up.
That's the beauty of it. I'm going to admit this, and I hope you don't get too mad or charged at me. I went on to the LAFC website to find your position so I can write out the description and to prepare for the interview. And I was scrolling down and scrolling down subconsciously thinking that this is me. This has nothing to do with you. Thinking in my head, we're at the bottom somewhere, right? Our position as a Vietnamese person is somewhere at the bottom. And then when I didn't find you, like the 80% that I scrolled for, because I started like at 80%, I was like, fuck the top. I'm just going to start from 80%, scroll down. And I was so disheartened to not see you at the bottom 80%. I'm like, oh my God, what if Benny doesn't work at LFC? And so I had to scroll back and check from the top. And you're like the third guy in the administration side. I was like, whoa, I didn't realize that is like, it was just... It reflects on how I look at myself and I reflected on that moment thinking, you know, is this the kind of programming that, you know, throughout the years where I wouldn't expect like an executive to be that high up that list that I'm scrolling at the bottom 80% to find Benny Tran's name. Now, what exactly at that level do you do day to day?
First of all, I don't know what to say about that, but just look at the top and down. And look, it depends on how it's set up. But I'm very fortunate to report to an awesome boss, the president of the club, Larry Friedman, and love the man, and he's been great. There's a lot of things that I do cover. Cover external affairs. So I do a lot of work with the public policy work, relationships with government, and so forth, as it relates to our business. strategy for the club in terms of business strategy, work on things at operations. It was heavy in operations before. Now I'm focused more on the food and bev a little bit, but also international work such as World Cup 2026, international competitions, things like that. So, and there's other things that we're working on in the for the future that will be very exciting for the club and new opportunities. And that's kind of where that covers all the bases and a lot of fields. And it was kind of born out of, you know, evolution throughout the 8 years I've been here. But, the stadium project was a very big one. And even being part of the team, I have 10 people for the first year, year and a half, 2 years to think about how the hell do we build this thing, right? As a club, as a brand, the stadium has been tremendous. And when you are at a startup like that and trying to do something special like this, it's been an incredible journey. And so, again, I do cover a lot of bases, but that really covers kind of the breadth of what I do. It's been a phenomenal experience.
You travel overseas quite a bit to Dubai and Qatar and all over the Middle East, even now in your role. But what does that have to do with LAFC? I've always wanted to ask you, why are you going to the World Cup this year? What does it have to do with your job?
Oh, so World Cup, I think it's pleasure and also going for work. Luckily, working with the host committee of 2026, LA is one of the major cities to host the World Cup. So I will be observing the World Cup in Qatar to set us up for 2026, really is the main goal. And beforehand, the government invited me to come to check it out, because we're an LA football club. People know us globally. We are here in MLS, and MLS is one of the fastest growing leagues and a really important league when it comes to global soccer as a sport and a business. And look, America is a huge soccer market. And I think all the clubs are trying to figure out how to get into the market as well. So there's a lot of interest. So I think we're relevant globally. Our club is relevant globally. And that was kind of sparked the early travels to Qatar last year. But now I'm in the capacity of the LA 26. That's where I'm going. Otherwise, we do interact with Mexico quite a bit because of the nature of being in this region. And MLS is by nature a Canada and US league.
Now, this is going to be a child's question. Hopefully it's not too naive. What does it take for Vietnam to get to the World Cup and win it? Like, what is involved in that process?
If anyone could answer that, I think they would. But I'll give you a counter example. What would it take for the U.S. to win the World Cup? and we missed the World Cup last year. And in the 80s and 90s, we're like, the U.S. is rising. We're going to make it. And the whole, era of soccer moms, we're going to make it. And today, we haven't made it far. We're back in the World Cup. And there's hope that we can go far, but there's not hope. I mean, we know the extent of which we can go. That's kind of where we are. Now, you're talking about years and years and decades of development, right, in terms of players and the system and, every single child here, massive youth sports industry here. You're talking about Vietnam where there's no space to play anything because it's so tight and people love soccer there. And look at the successes of Vietnam today. They finally qualified for the World Cup qualifiers. And that was a massive for Vietnam as a country, for Vietnamese people, and hopefully for all Vietnamese people abroad, which is a whole interesting thing in terms of identity politics and affiliation, right? But at the end of the day, the people of the teams in Vietnam qualified to go to the World Cup, and they lost out in the group stages. But look at the women's team. They qualify the World Cup. They're playing the U.S. actually for the first game in 2024. I believe it's 2024. But yeah, Vietnam women's team has made the World Cup. Incredible. And where we have gotten to, and again, compared to this country where we have all the resources in the world, Vietnam has made it. I think it's a tremendous step forward. And to win the World Cup, there's a lot of things that you have to figure out. And then the many, many countries that have always won, Brazil and France, that has always been there. It's about, us trying to get there, but we're on the pathway. It's really incredible to see. And the growth of sport in Vietnam as well, right? In terms of basketball, how we play the SEA Games, Vietnamese American players playing
In
for
Vietnam.
Vietnam national teams, right? Young people, I mean, it's incredible. And then the sense of pride that comes in. This is where LAFC represents the people of LA. The US men's national team will represent America at the World Cup. And it's how, Vietnamese will represent the World Cup for the women's team. And it's that sense of pride behind that and nationalism behind it and what that flag represents. And it's that.
Talking about the flag, it's a very always a very touchy subject, and I don't know when it's going to get better, and I don't know sort of how to navigate it other than going right through to the question, right? Because this is such a big thing. We are a tiny fraction of the Vietnamese population around the world. I don't know how many, we're 2 million around, or 2 to 3 million diaspora, and you have 98 million in Vietnam represented under the red flag with the star. Now, we on everywhere else, we're like these floating satellites, right, of the Vietnamese culture. When does this whole sort of conversation about like how we and our children are going to identify with different flags? Like we cannot perish and die in the United States under the satellite condition, I feel. Is there a time that we are ever going to reconcile with saying, you know what? Perhaps we should be open, or do we always exist with two different flags? What's your take? What's your feel on that as a sports person?
As a sports person, I think that there's a lot of feelings as not a sports person either.
That can we answer it in, can you answer it in with a sports hat? And then with a Vietnamese American diaspora son
Sure.
hat.
So what's gonna so here's my question. What's gonna happen when Vietnam the Vietnamese women's national team is going to play in the World Cup? Are people going to not watch it? Are people will watch it? Will people see that it represents them or not represent them? And I have a feeling that it will represent them. Actually, now that you mentioned it, this is a seminal moment for Vietnamese. The women's team have committed to the highest level of competition in the world. And yes, the flag is on their chest, it's on above their heart, and they represent a nation. And it's a nation of 100 million people. So who's against that? That very small population here. So how are they going to represent themselves? That's a question for them. And I think it's a question that is generational,
Wait a
right?
minute, but that's a question for them. That shit happened 50 years ago. Yeah, there's a lot of lives lost. I get it. I get the emotions behind it. But on some level, we are living in the present moment. How are we expected to identify with an experience that's happening right now under a basically, it's a symbol of something that happened 50 years ago, and it was something that is part of our history, a very much part of it. I cannot enjoy this experience of sharing the Women's World Cup's participation if they're going to run around with this different symbol of what I was raised with, right? I'm just speaking on sort of like this general rhetoric of there's two different things that are being, represented. And it's important because all these sports bars in Orange County, if they're watching this Women's World Cup game, I mean, how are we supposed to navigate around this?
I think it's a level of acceptance, right? Look, we're not here to take away any of the bad experience, the terrible experience that people kind of went through. I think what we live in the past, or we live in the present, or we live in the future. When we live in the future, I think that's going to be where I think some of these folks need to answer that question. And the future here also is, what about the generation that has grown up after the war? I remember it was 10 years ago or 12 years ago, where two-thirds of the population in Vietnam was born after the war. They had zero inkling of what happened. So, but today must be 80%, 90%. and also the young population here. You know, I think there's some level of conditioning. What I've learned is there's some level of conditioning about Vietnam, but at the same time, people are going back to Vietnam now. So it's like you can't just say, oh, I might get to Vietnam. Like, oh, it's okay. I'm just going to Vietnam. It's going to be great because the clubs are great. The food's great. I'm going to party and enjoy it, right? So this is very kind of dichotomous and contrarian in terms of, in the sense that that's what's happening. But I think everyone needs to get to a level of acceptance. And we recognize that Vietnam right now is a burgeoning country, one of the fastest growing countries in the world. It was the fastest growing Asian country, more than China before. Before COVID, and it's a bright shining star when it comes to, you know, developing countries, right? Look at it, the reduction of poverty that's happened in the country, the amount of growth that's growing now, the amount of manufacturing that's moved from agrarian to they're building, you know, Galaxy phones, right? I think that, you know, that acceptance and acceptance of young people, and look, they're non, I'd say, people who are grew up in abroad who are participating in the national team as well. What does that represent to them? They are Vietnamese and represent themselves under the flag. So I can't tell you what people will do, but I think it's also generational, right? When young people like us, I was born after the war. What are they saying? How are they experiencing it? And maybe it's along with the political lines too, right? There is a movement to blue in the young people, but hopefully it's something that we can get past. Let's go to the cat sports bars in Orange County and say, hey, did you play? Did you show the Vietnam game when they're qualifying for the World Cup? Did you watch it when they played China? Were you cheering for Vietnam when they played against China? And I would guarantee you, they say, of course, right?
Damn, I should bring a camera down there and interview some of the patrons and stuff like that. Let's switch over to dancing because that's a burning question for me. You dance a lot in the Latino clubs. You shake that booty quite a bit. And how is it that somebody who is really so into the Vietnamese culture, but yet has such a one foot in really in the clubs and the dancing and the Latino culture. When did that start to take shape for you?
It's interesting. It really took shape when I was really young. Michael Jackson was my man. And when I was four, I was jumping around the living room, like dancing to Michael Jackson. So it's always been a part of me. And it's been an evolution, you know. It was actually really an expression of myself, you know, breaking out. I was a very young, shy kid, if you can believe it. A late blossomer, young, shy, introverted, was very timid. And so when I was very young, I was already into music and dancing. And then when I got to high school, when I actually left, it was my first time leaving home. And I got to experience living in the dorms, interacting with new people, international, local, and learn how to dance. And it taught me how to have rhythm. And then there you go to Egypt, and everybody kind of does the whole belly dancing thing, you know, not interacting. And then when I got back to college, I kind of, you know, fell in love with swinging, and really tried to swing. And I even taking state
Oh
classes
shit, so you are
before
real. I just thought it was like bachata and cumbia and all this stuff.
clubs.
Swinging is like, that's some real, yeah.
And one could argue that I learned hip hop dancing through osmosis. Who knows, right? Like, you know, we live in Atlanta, but yeah, I mean, you get rhythm, and I just enjoy dancing. And it's look, it was great. You know, in Vietnam, it's like people don't dance, but they dance. You know, and now people go to the
Wait, what do you mean by that? That break that down. That's some funny shit. They
and
like to move, but they don't do technical dancing. Is that what you're saying?
they dance. There's always a subpopulation that does technical dancing, ballet. There's also my great friend Darren Joe is a basically Asian man who is a professional at dancing bachata and salsa. But yeah, I mean it's not like Latinos where everyone dances. And my friend said, oh yeah, but I'm Colombian. I just dance like a Colombian, like as one Colombian does, right? That means that the baseline is I know how to dance everything basically more than basically the rest of the world. The Vietnamese same baseline is not this dancing is not a part of our culture. You know, but in today's world, people do like to go to clubs, they do dance, and depending on varying levels, like you know, people dance at the clubs and or maybe not, right? And that's just part of the evolution of also even clubs here in America, right? People that kind of don't dance, they kind of hover around the table. And I think that's a I think that, you know, my theory is 90s hip hop was an era of which some of us resonate, even the young people resonate, but the beats are very complex in terms of movement. And now you fast forward to today's world, it's very simple beats. You don't have to move that much. It's not complex. And I don't know. I think generally people dance kind of less, but like that's LA versus you go to Atlanta, you go to Miami, everybody's dancing, right? So there's different cultures between even in the US, but in Asia, it's different, right? In terms of, the baseline of what we were as Vietnamese. You cha 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 cha, but that's the extent of
Yeah,
like
that's a max.
dancing, right?
Yeah.
But now, yeah, I mean, when I dance at a club in Vietnam, it's fun and people think it's fun. And that's where I enjoy it. And I learned salsa dancing and bachata, they're great things. I just love how that moves and how you interact with your partner. And I think culturally, it's wonderful. I wish that we had that culture among Vietnamese or Southeast Asians too. It's not the same.
It's not, but even in LA, there's, I can ha name a few, like the Mayan, Congo Room. Like there's just, it's not that much either in LA versus Miami or Columbia, right? It's just doesn't really appeal to a lot of people.
It's very strange, right? And you can probably five, six, seven places in LA that do it. And it's interesting because there's a salsa dance that is uniquely Los Angeles that is called that, right?
Wow.
So, but I mean, I have no idea why there's not in more places, whether it be demand or is it a supply issue? I don't know. We go to Miami, every single corner, somebody's salsa dancing. It's a different thing. And whether or not, I mean, there's a complexity behind, I think, with political identity and how people approach it. Miami, they speak Spanish. If you don't speak Spanish, I don't really care. That's who they are.
Yeah.
And also it might be regional, right? Like it's bachata, salsa, Caribbean based, South American based. This is my heavily Mexican population. But what's changing is I think that reggaeton is changing, a lot of that, right? Reggaeton is being more mainstream among. You'll hear reggaeton in London. You'll hear reggaeton. Don't you even sit at the club?
Yeah, you're starting to see Vietnamese artists get into reggaeton style rap or music that is based with reggaeton beats. I just talked to a rapper about that. You know, they're starting to infuse this sort of Vietnamese words and cultures and ideas into reggaeton, which is very interesting.
Yeah, but it's a dominant cultural movement, right? And that's what now I think that's changing for Latinos too. Like, oh, this is Latino. Look what has Korean film K-pop has done for Korea in terms of culture movements and acceptance and recognition. It's those are global movements. I think Korea is having a moment in many different regards. Mexico in itself, right? Mexican food,
Yeah.
film. Things like that. Mexico specifically, look at the growth of taco places around the world. In Singapore, when I was there 10 years ago, there were like two or three. Now it's a lot more than that. You'll see taco places all over the world now. It's become a thing, right? So.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of being Vietnamese now. It's like we're, at ground zero, in 2020, to me, 2022, like we're ground zero. Now we have like things like the sympathizer where, the kids, really, they're kids. They're like in their 20s that were casted for these main roles. Seven or eight of them, I've never even heard of them. But in 2 years from now, these guys are going to be, they're going to be the next wave of representing. They're good-looking men, they're good-looking women that are going to be representing the Vietnamese all around the world with this HBO series with the Sympathizer. And that is so fucking exciting to me.
So exciting, right? Based on that book, there's a lot of things that I think that will come
Open
with
up.
and open up. It's great.
Yeah, it's good for all of us. Now, my last question is, went by fast, right?
Very
Given
fast.
a chance in the future to retire, would you do it in Vietnam or US, or where would it be?
I don't know. I think it'll depend on, my family, if I have a family relative to my family, my parents, my brother, sister, or contextually where it can be. Look, Europe is very nice, has a different lifestyle to enjoy yourself and be relaxed and a really nice place to live. It could be Vietnam, but Vietnam's a little bit busier, but it could be in the outskirts of Vietnam. I really don't know, but those are great places to look at, or it could be like San Diego, California, where you have A great environment, weather. It's weather's great, no mosquitoes or some mosquitoes, but not a lot. So not sure, but those are the things that I would hope to aspire to be. And look, at the end of the day, if I had multiple homes in different places, that would be ideal,
Not a
right?
bad, yeah,
Not
that's not a bad way to live.
a bad way to live.
Because of our trauma and because of the way that sort of we ran away and chayak and all of that, I always have this thought in my mind, watching my mom and dad and their friends, that you should be able to be ready to live in any country at any given time. And I think you exemplify that. I mean, just your energy, I can imagine you sort of taking this sort of ethos into Europe or Brazil, wherever you live, and you have a wonderful life within bringing your Vietnamese identity to wherever you go. And I think that's a wonderful thing that I've learned a lot by watching you.
I think that's really interesting you say that. And when you ask about me being Vietnamese, I know how to make pho, and I know how to make bún mọc, and I know how to make bánh xèo. That's always will be with me. And hell, if I ever, as you warned me, not to open restaurants per se, because it's so hard, and I've learned that. I love it. I love it. And I will never stop talking about Vietnamese food. I talk about other food too, but like the complexities of Vietnam, Vietnamese food, what that means culture and how delicious it is, I just can't let that go, and it'll be with me forever.
Benny, thank you so much for finally coming on to the
Thanks for
podcast. And I really, really appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man.
having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Benny.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.